The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. The serfs are internet comedians who turn their biting wit against the true enemies of the working class, i.e. Joe Rogan, PewDiePie, and Liam Neeson. Their names are Lance and Dave, and they put out a podcast and a YouTube video, or more than one probably, every week. And they are the guest on this week's podcast here at Zero Books. It's Wednesday, May 22nd, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. This week's podcast is available in full for everyone. Our Patreon supporters get access to two podcasts every week, most of the time, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. But if you're listening on our free feed, you'll always be able to access one or the other podcast each week. At the moment, we have 592 patrons, which is down two from last time I said anything about this, but we did reach 600 patrons in April. Therefore, we'll introduce the new series of Patreon-only videos entitled Communism from the 70s. I think I'm going to say Communism from the 70s by the end of May, and I expect that we'll be able to get over 600 again and continue on with the series in the months to come. Let's hope so. So if you're listening and you want to hear and see those videos, become a Patreon supporter. The music you're listening to right now is PewDiePie's hit Bitch Lasagna, as played by Davey504 for 10 hours. Don't worry, I won't play it all. In just a moment, you'll be listening to the serfs explain why it is that everyone poops.
Well, hello, I'm Lance.
And I'm Dave.
And I guess together we are the Serfs. We are a Canadian, I wouldn't describe us as a comedy duo. We're kind of just like basement barrel, dumpster fire-esque attempts at being comedians.
Political comedians,
yes. A thriving and profitable industry, and one everyone should join.
Yeah. So how did you guys meet up, and how did you decide to become online comedians? Were you doing stand-up, or?
Oh, we should have said online comedians. That's even worse.
No, I mean, like, so we met through university years ago, decade ago,
yep.
Over that. And we've been very good friends ever since.
You know, people would often say that we would spend time at parties instead of being cool and flirting with the people that we were attracted to, just in the corner rambling off about politics.
Yeah. Sounds like a typical member of the YDS today.
Yes, exactly.
So you met in college, and I guess you've known each other for a decade. When did you decide to create the serfs, and did it have anything to do with Donald Trump that you decided to jump online and your politics flow?
Well, I mean, Trump, the election of Trump, obviously, for, I guess, most of even Canadians, right? It doesn't matter what part of the world you were in, was just kind of a shell shock, even though it shouldn't have been if you were actually paying close attention to what was going on behind the scenes at the time. But yeah, that wasn't the exact reason we started a podcast. We started doing a podcast because we actually originally had a friend that we found quite hilarious, and we wanted to talk about the news with him.
That's right.
Yeah, on the podcast.
And that sort of fell through. And we just sort of thought, because we were talking politics all the time, and as Lance mentioned, we would spend a lot of times at parties and in social gatherings talking politics. And people seem to say, hey, you guys are funny when you guys talk about politics. We thought, you know, why not have a go at it? I think at that time, we were also listening to a lot of podcasts online, like Chapo and just various different political ones in Canada and mm-hmm. stuff as well.
Better Off Red, too, and yeah. some other good left-wing podcasts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
all these new people, all these newcomers to the field of left-wing podcasts.
Oh, have you guys been around for a very, very long time, I take it?
Yeah. I started podcasting from the left in 2009.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So at that time it was called Diet Soap, and I was already middle aged, 38 years old. So yeah, so I'm a real oldster in a number of ways for this scene. But and I've noticed in the last, I would say, really because of Chapo, there's just been a flood of new young talent, and I'm losing my edge.
Yeah, I mean, luckily ageism isn't really prevalent in left-wing politics.
How many times a day do you get called an old white
dude? Well, that was the first, but thank you.
Well, no, I'm not worried about ageism, but I just age. Just getting old. Okay, but so then you started a podcast with an RSS feed and all of that, right?
Yeah, and we did the typical.
I see you on YouTube now, but I have to admit I haven't even listened to your podcast.
I don't think a lot of our fans are.
Yeah, I feel now with our YouTube blowing up, it's people are more inclined to watch our stuff on YouTube rather than listen to our stuff on podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the question, I guess, of the hour for, you know, opportunistic media types like ourselves. Should we all just be, you know, jumping over from podcasting onto YouTube, where there seems to be – actually, there was for a long time a dearth of material there. I mean, it was just sort of handed over to the Ben Shapiros of the world and worse.
Yeah, totally. So for us, I mean, we were obviously people who, you know, of the generation where people go on YouTube all the time or watching YouTube videos, and like anyone else, realizing what the algorithms of YouTube are doing, right? You go down those like rabbit holes. I'll watch one video on maybe like, you know, the history of Kafka or something like that, and all of a sudden my feed is filled up with 10,000 you know, intellectual dark web videos, Jordan Peterson owning this guy, crushing this person with logic, Ben Shapiro dropping logic bombs. And it's upsetting, because why exactly does the YouTube algorithm reward that content so much? And then you start trying to find left-wing content. And there, you know, at that time, there was a lot of big names. There was, you know, H Bomber Guy, ContraPoints, Philosophy Tube. But they were kind of – oh, and Sean and Three Arrows. I should be dropping all the names proper. But we wanted to contribute to that too. Like, I had a background in video. I mean, that's my day job, is working as an editor and stuff. So me and Dave started producing video content as well, as just kind of like a side, just to kind of help, I guess – add some propaganda to the other side of the coin.
You know, from my perspective, ContraPoints is also a kind of a newbie. I mean, she's doing great and she's the biggest thing around, but I think she started before the election of Trump, but really started getting traction after. I'm not sure, but I know she had a channel for a while and then started really focusing on it relatively recently. I think the last 3 years have been big years for that, her channel. And so, like, if you're looking before 2015 or 14, you're really looking at the age, not even of the IDW, you're looking at like these new atheist
amazing atheists and all those other terrible figures.
The anti-social justice warrior people who originally, I guess, started out to try to prove that God doesn't exist and decided along the way they might as well prove that feminism is bad. Yeah. Yeah.
The true enemy is the vagina.
Right. So, and that was a really big deal before Trump and before, I mean, that's what, you know, I want to move to some of your videos. Like, you critiqued PewDiePie, who, by the way, I've recently subscribed to his channel because I was told to several times. I'm sort of shocked. I mean, he doesn't seem like an evil guy, but this is what 94 million people are subscribed to. Is there some guy in his room going, Loai? I don't
know. Yeah, I mean, sure, you know, this is one of those aspects that show that the younger demographic really caters towards YouTube and follows YouTube celebrities and gets their entertainment from there. Because even for us, we're too old to fall within PewDiePie's general audience. But kids had been following him for years as just a basic video game streamer,
yeah.
Which is like incredibly popular online and has been for quite some time now to watch people, your favorite, you know, online celebrity play video games. And at the same time, I guess PewDiePie was really at the forefront of that and was able to amass a large following. And I guess as years go by, his followers grow up with him. So he sort of translates that online edgy edgelord video game character and is able to personify that up on YouTube.
How edgy is PewDiePie, or was he?
Right.
Has he changed?
So like, there's PewDiePie is interesting because like, there's a lot of the stuff he did. Like, you know, there's the accusations of racism for him doing things like dropping a hard N bomb on a live stream, for example, right? Like, those are just parts of his character, clearly. Or you know, he would play jokes where you can pay people on Fiverr to do basically anything. So he would pay people poorer than him basically to hold up signs that say Hitler did nothing wrong, you know, things like that. But again, it sounds more like the antics of like a 17-year-old, you know, like we said, it's kind of falling into that category of the edgelords doing things for the lulz, whether or not it's actually, you know, he's intentionally trying to indoctrinate people into, you know, some kind of white nationalist movement. I don't accuse him of that, and I don't think that. At the same time, the more you looked into PewDiePie, the more you realized the guy was following figures like Stephen Molyneux and Ben Shapiro and Lauren Southern on Twitter. Like, he actually had a collection of these figures, and he would mention from time to time how he watched them and liked them. Like, he would send Ben Shapiro memes, for example. So Ben Shapiro on his show would say, PewDiePie sent me these memes. So he would kind of cross-pollinate a little bit with, you know, what we now call the intellectual dark web. And in the case of Stephen Molyneux, all the way into, I guess, white nationalism light, if you can classify him as that.
Right. What is the deal with Jordan Peterson and PewDiePie? Did they actually do a show together?
No, they never did a show together. It was Dave Rubin who kind of roped Jordan Peterson into the PewDiePie movement. So when you said, you just mentioned earlier, you subscribed to PewDiePie because you were told to do so, right? What happened is
like, not just once.
there's an Indian music conglomerate called T-Series. And because internet has become way more prevalent in India, there's a lot more access to YouTube. And as that's happened, there's obviously millions and millions of more people subscribing to this music conglomerate called T-Series. So it started a battle between, will PewDiePie remain the number one subscribed YouTuber, or will this new up and coming YouTube channel from India take him over? So that's where the whole subscribe to PewDiePie kind of race war began.
And the ethical side of that argument to subscribe to PewDiePie was not that we don't want an Indian channel to be the number one channel, but that we didn't want a corporate channel to be the number one channel. Yeah, that was what the argument was. Like, hey, this is a little guy, any guy. It's a David and Goliath story, only David has already got 60 million followers at the start.
Yeah, I mean, I could be wrong. Maybe Lance can correct me on this, but I believe that I thought I had read that PewDiePie was the biggest earner on YouTube out of all the YouTube stars.
Oh, he was, yes. Yeah. He was, and especially before all his kind of like, you know, soft Nazi stuff came out, that's when he lost a lot of his sponsors. He was, you know, he was about to get his own TV show from Disney. He was on YouTube's high-end subscriber service. He had his own show, Tried to Scare PewDiePie, which is like a reality series, and he lost all that from his antics, shall we say.
But I heard recently that even if after all that, he makes something like $19 million a year.
Oh, easily. That's just off YouTube ad revenue. That's not saying all the other ancillary revenue sources that he might have, right? Which, yeah, I'm sure are very numerous and lucrative. And back to your Jordan Peterson call. So it was Dave Rubin that actually told Jordan Peterson, here's what's going on. And then Jordan Peterson in a public video said, I'm subscribing to PewDiePie. And so that's what it was. Okay.
And I believe PewDiePie also referenced Jordan Peterson and showed up his books.
I forgot about that. Yeah. So PewDiePie does book reviews every now and then and actually reviewed the 12 Rules for Life on his channel. And, you know, to his credit, did make a point of saying this book is overwhelmingly saturated with religious, you know, text. And yeah, PewDiePie did say that.
Oh, he did say that.
Yeah, he does mention that. He's like, it's a lot more religious than I thought it would be, but it does have some great steps for cleaning your room and, you know, lobsters.
Right. Well, I knew that PewDiePie reviewed books, and I actually considered trying to send him one of my novels to see if he'd review it. I mean, I'm not above that.
Was that for Bash Bash Revolution?
Yeah, I thought that would be a pretty good fit.
That's a good entry point. Yeah. I can see that. Yeah.
I haven't done it because I'm lazy, I think. So we got PewDiePie. He's an edgelord, but I feel like he's more of a symptom of the algorithm than he is a leader of it.
Yeah, like I said, I don't actively think that PewDiePie is trying to recruit kids into white nationalism, and we've never said that. In the video we made about him, we were kind of trying to describe the problem with fake racism, or at least the problem with doing racist stuff for the lulz, right? Which is – it's a very popular tactic of people in 4chan. And I mean, PewDiePie's most recent screw-up, if you will, was that he likes to give out shout-outs to smaller channels. And he gave a shout-out to a channel called E semicolon R. And E semicolon R is a channel that's riddled with red pill content, you know, a lot of homophobic content, a lot of anti-trans content.
Anti-Semitic
content. Anti-Semitic content as well. So it's definitely like – it would not be something that you should be recommending to smaller kids to subscribe to. And just by PewDiePie recommending him, that channel overnight got 250,000 subscribers. Yeah.
And he claims he didn't know what was on that channel.
Yeah, that's correct. He says he saw one specific video and that's why he was
like drawn to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, when it comes to PewDiePie and his tactics, like we said, what we wanted to investigate a little bit more is just so people understand the idea of this 4chan culture where people like to joke about racist things up until the point where they might be able to convince someone, right? And it also it insulates them. It gives them security. I mean, you can say like, oh, it's just a prank, bro, right? Yeah,
it's just I'm not serious. It's just a joke.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But okay. So my question is like, how do we do something about this beyond telling edgelords not to be edgelords? Because the unfortunate fact is like you can say or you can make a video saying, hey, even light racism or, you know, kind of ironic racism has bad consequences over the long haul. It can lead a lot of people, especially if you're a media type, you can lead a lot of people down very bad paths. You can say that. And I think in the case of PewDiePie, it seems that he has really tried, maybe not succeeded, to rein that part of his channel back, you know, pull it back. I mean, it's cost him a lot. I don't think he wants to do that kind of thing anymore. But nonetheless, there's something generating this, and it's not just these individual YouTubers. It's I guess it's the algorithm or something else. It's maybe it's the fact that the internet's a kind of like the Wild West. And the Chan culture, I mean, you're going to find that. You're going to find, I don't know, you can get drugs pretty easily now, I understand, because of the internet.
And how.
And all sorts of other contraband, including, I guess, child pornography is running around online. What do we do to moderate or regulate this stuff?
So we actually spoke recently to Faraday Speaks, which I don't know if your listeners are aware of him, but he is an ex alt-right member, or he likes to say alt-light, who has subsequently kind of deprogrammed himself. Through a lot of online YouTubers, actually, like Destiny and ContraPoints helped deprogram him. He laid it out pretty easily as someone who used to be indoctrinated by the algorithm and by the right-wing rhetoric online, that there's, first off, you'll never be able to differentiate between people joking and not joking. And honestly, as two, like, you know, amateur basement barrel comedians, like we're very pro. You should be able as a comedian to joke about whatever you want. But at the end of the day, you know, that doesn't excuse you, like, you know, from what the consequences will be, you know. Freedom of speech isn't freedom of consequence, basically. So if PewDiePie wants to make really crappy jokes about, you know, people poorer than him holding up signs that are embarrassing to them, like that's his prerogative. But at the end of the day, people can also judge him based on that. In terms of the greater symptom, though, Faraday Speaks was saying that the best way to combat this is people on the left need to start producing a lot of this content, putting it out there, doing the same strategies that the right has done, which is to cross-pollinate each other. Dave Rubin cross-pollinates with Joe Rogan, who cross-pollinates with Stefan Molyneux, who cross-pollinates with all the way down the ladder. You know, you can do 6 degrees of Goebbels and work your way all the way to Richard Spencer eventually, right? Yeah. And the other thing is to combat a lot of that with, you know, positive memes, things like that. I mean, it sounds corny, but like that stuff does work. When you make these people look ridiculous, which is what we try to do, we make a lot of, you know, we make Stefan Molyneux look like an abject racist trying to push racist pills down people's throats. Or we try to make Jordan Peterson look like a sex addict who's trying to, you know, indoctrinate people into his weird sex cult. By doing that, you ridicule those figures, right?
Well, I have to ask you guys what you thought of the Zizek Peterson debate, because my feeling at the end of it was that while I still had lots of things that I wanted to debate Zizek about, actually, that just in terms of a rhetorical win, just in terms of, you know, in the meme wars, that was a massive win for the left. I thought that to see them on stage together. But did you guys think so? What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, I mean, I feel that personally, I thought I expected more out of Jordan Peterson. I don't know why. I mean, that's my mistake. But I thought he would come prepared to really present his real arguments why Marxism is bad and really be the rallying figure for his, you know, acolytes to bash the left and prove his like greater intellectual
not having superiority. Read Das Kapital for like 5 minutes before the
yeah, of the and, debate. And from like the very outset, it seemed like he was just out of his element, and Zizek was able to just, you know, counter, we're not even almost counter, just it just felt like he was mocking him in a lot of ways.
I'll tell you my favorite part of the debate was where Zizek finally, and this is finally in a public forum, someone called Jordan Peterson out for the whole cultural Marxism thing. Like, can you give me one example, concrete example of a cultural Marxist in today's day and age? And even Zizek was like, I can name you Marxist professors, but can you tell me one cultural Marxist? And, it, you know, eventually Peterson looked sad and looked at the floor and was like, well, you know, the social programs of 26% more, you know, female to male ratios. And but yeah, it was obviously like out of his league, because it is a grift, right? Like the whole cultural Marxism thing is a bit of, you know, a Peterson grift. That I was happy with. I wasn't happy with the bromance going down between those two. Like, the whole middle section, like, there was so many, like, that was a moment where people on the left, I think, were frothing at the mouth for someone of, you know, Zizek's caliber to start taking Peterson down.
See, I think I disagree with you on that front, and here's why. It is, if Zizek had been more adversarial, then it would have given Peterson an out in terms of having to address substantive criticism later. Because he built rapport with Peterson, there was no way for Peterson just to become insulting.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. That's interesting. But I mean, we both find Zizek a bit of a complicated figure as well, right? Like, there's things I love about Zizek, and then there's things that I really dislike about him. You know, I haven't really enjoyed the way he stumbled through the transphobia issue, or, you know, he's had accusations of kind of Islamophobic refugee call-outs numerous TV shows. I mean, those are the aspects of Zizek I'm not a huge fan of, whereas I do like his statements of the absurdity of today's world. Like when he says that we live in the most ideological times, but we also believe in nothing. Like, that's, you know, a really interesting and profound statement for me. But yeah, I wanted to see Jordan Peterson debate Richard Wolff. Like, I think you guys did as well, right?
Yeah, I did. But after seeing Zizek debate Peterson, I don't think Wolff would have done better. I actually think Zizek was the right choice in terms of meme and rhetorical content and all of that. I mean, if you want to see someone really go after Peterson on Marx, you know, who would you pick? I mean, unfortunately, the thing is, from my perspective, and I have a weird perspective because I've gone through the sectarian left a little bit, like, the best Marxist economist to debate Jordan Peterson would also be something of a lunatic and an unhinged person. So what I would say is that you have to kind of pick how far you want to go in your debates. Like, if we had put Richard Wolff or David Harvey or someone like that, who's a pretty good Marxist, against Jordan Peterson, what you would find was that the depth of the disagreement, I mean, not that Zizek doesn't have a very deep disagreement with Peterson, but the focus on Marx and the economic angle, I think, would have given Peterson an out in a way that Zizek, as a Lacanian psychoanalyst, kind of didn't give him an out, because you can just bring him down, Peterson down, to this point of like, look, do you believe in freedom for the individual or not? And if you do, then let's debate what that would really be. And I think Zizek was good at that. The other thing I'll say, just on the defend Zizek a little bit, as the transphobic accusations or transphobia accusations and the accusations about refugees, I interviewed him around the time that book came out. That was not the only thing behind the accusations, but it was It was a piece that he'd written in The Guardian to promote that book, I think, or somewhere along those lines, that got him in a lot of trouble. And as always with Žižek, he says inflammatory things, but he also, if you read him carefully, isn't actually saying things that are as quite inflammatory as you think, and you have to interpret him. And I would just say that that an honest fight with Žižek around transgender issues would be done on the level of like Judith Butler. Like, you would really have to say, like, Žižek has a different perspective on sexuality than the people who are sort of creating the theoretical basis for a lot of transgender politics. And so there's like these deep differences in their ideas, and they're not actually just knee-jerk differences, or it's not like they don't have the same aim of emancipation for transgender people. I don't think it's a good starting point to think of Žižek's problems with trans people as coming from transphobia, because that makes it his own like personal bias or something. He actually has a theoretical difference with the kinds of transgender activists that...
Right, but you could also argue that he just kind of lacks nuance when it comes to dealing with those issues. And when it comes to marginalized people, that is actually a field that would require some nuance, especially in the language you use, for example. And I understand that's not his forte. Like, Žižek is known for being a provocateur, and he's known for being, you know, the pervert's guide to blank, right? And that part... And that can be very entertaining in some aspects, but this happens to be one aspect that it required some nuance, in my opinion.
When you say nuance, you mean sensitivity, or
yes,
you
know, that as well. Yeah.
Because his arguments were nuanced, but they were also put across with a club.
Yeah, of course.
So that's the other thing I guess I want to ask you is to what extent does the left need to be able to toughen up when it comes to these kinds of disagreements or like feeling offended, and to what extent do we do ourselves a favor by setting some sort of social etiquette guidelines as to how we behave online and how other people should be expected to behave?
I think the bigger problem with the left is not that we're too sensitive. It's that we self-cannibalize quite a bit. There's a lot of purity tests, and people are never quite left enough sometimes. And that creates a lot of infactions. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of factions in the right as well, and we're probably not as aware of them because we don't, you know.
I mean, we're lucky how factionalized and split and fucked up they are. I think that you're right. But okay, so when it comes to self-cannibalizing, I think part of it, though, is this culture of offense. Because here's the thing. Everybody and their brother wants to be the most left person in the room. Every theoretical, you know, the anarchists think that they're the most left. The Marxists think, no, the anarchists are bourgeois. We're the most left. You know, and if those are the kind of litmus tests we're going to use on each other, there's never going to be any kind of big tent. There can't even be a big tent amongst Marxists. I mean, they're the worst at, you know, excluding one another and throwing each other. You get these sects that come down to like three members, and not just like marginalized sects. The Situationist International is this great story of just expulsion after expulsion. And we'd still talk about them, but, you know, it ended up of a group of three people, and one of which they were kind of half excluding because it wasn't part of the actual literal marriage that was at the heart of the Situationist International at that point. Anyway, I don't know where I'm
going. It's kind of like that balancing act, right? You're just constantly trying to, as a leftist, not be an overwhelming hypocrite in your everyday life and your everyday composure. But at the same time, I think the process is a constant learning process. Like when we started this podcast 3 years ago, there was a lot of issues that we were frankly uneducated on, right? So it's something that we've constantly had to learn about and try to be more sensitive when it comes to certain languages and pronouns and pronunciations and stuff like that. And I really have no problem with doing that because at the end of the day, like I said, we are talking about marginalized people. So, you know, I think that's a small price on one end to pay to have to maybe adjust the language used around certain situations.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and the difficulty, though, as you point out, is that it's not just a matter of, you know, using the right pronoun or saying he, she, instead of just he. I mean, I'm going back to like the 80s for that kind of, I mean, that's long dead, but you know what I'm saying? It's not just a matter of catching up with what's polite, but there's also these real differences between different parts of the left. And we're not very good right now at talking to each other about those differences. And it probably doesn't have anything to do with pronoun uses. Or anything like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of infighting. I mean, and you know, there's weird labels being thrown out. People sometimes call us Soros-funded conspiracy hacks or something like that.
Yeah,
and then where is our Soros money? Like, I'm still waiting. It would be lovely to have some Soros money right now.
Yeah, I feel that this has been a long problem of the left, right? That there is no big tent for people in the left. Everybody's just sort of broken up and to the extent where everybody's bickering over a leftist policy, everybody would rather see the entire paradigm shift towards the left, but nobody's able to, I guess, hold hands and sort of row the boat in the same way. I don't know how to fix it. I feel like if we keep our eyes on the same, I guess, big focus, things will sort of transfix towards there. But I don't know. I see what you're referencing, and I've thought about that myself for quite a long time, and I don't quite see a solution to it, like a genuine compromise that will please the majority. Obviously, you can never please everybody, but I feel it's tough to get everybody on the same page.
Yeah, I mean, I think a starting point would be if you are like, you know, a communist or an anarchist or an anarcho-communist, to not simply label someone like Bernie Sanders as the same as the right, for example, right?
Right,
like,
that's a good idea.
Well, it's, yeah. I mean, like, people don't believe in incremental change and, you know, fair enough, because we have, what, like 10 years before we can irreversibly change global warming, so there's not a lot of time left for small incremental change.
Isn't that an optimistic view? I thought I heard that 10 years ago.
But anyway, you know, yeah. So in the meantime, what's the alternative? Don't vote. Don't take any action. Don't become involved. Or even worse, are you going to start, you know, claiming that people who are Sock Dems, that they're the enemy as well, that they're just, you know, a different version of the corporate mechanism that keeps capitalism in power? I think Bernie Sanders would be a huge breath of fresh air for the United States. I would love to see that. You know, I think it would be a monstrous pendulum shift. So I think it behooves everyone on the left to try and work towards that if you're in that area or that field.
Okay, well, that leads me to my next question, which is how are you guys planning on covering, which is it's well underway in a sick and sad way. It's like Christmas. It's always the season is always getting to be earlier and earlier. So we're well into the 2020 campaign, sadly. How are you guys going to handle that? You know, because it's going to be a time of internal warfare on the left.
Well, we're part of the Yang Gang, baby. Get our sweet UBI.
They'll give UBI to Canadians, right?
You know, yeah, of course.
I didn't expect that. You just did George Bernie Sanders for 15 minutes. Okay.
Yeah, Sanders didn't give me no money.
Well, okay. Well, I'm about to interview Mike Gravel.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. Next week. Which is
That's an incredibly high profile interview. Is it going to be the surf?
Is it a high profile interview, or is it a bit like interviewing an Elvis impersonator? I'm not sure. Here's the funny thing about Mike Gravel is that he ran in 2008 against Obama, right? And I remembered that. I remembered seeing him, you know, during the primaries, running against, you know, Hillary and Obama during that time. And in 2016, when Bernie Sanders came on the scene, I said, "Oh, he's back," because I had confused him with Mike Gravel. For the longest time, I thought Sanders had run twice. So it's sort of sad. It's maybe, you know, have you heard of this thing, the Bernstein effect?
No.
Is that based on the Bernstein Bears?
It is. It's based on the Bernstein Bears. The Bernstein is also known as the Mandela effect.
Oh, I've heard of the Mandela effect, but how does it differ from the Bernstein effect? Because that's a new one to me.
It's the same thing. It's just that Bernstein is spelled with an AI and everyone remembers it.
Okay.
And the Mandela effect is, you know, Nelson Mandela died in the 80s. We all remember. Yeah. Some idiots remember. So that's my Bernstein.
Understandable.
Bernie Sanders has turned into Mike Gravel.
Well, for us and what we're going to be doing, you know, comedy wise with these new figures, there are some people that I think are fair game to, you know, take on right now, like, you know, Beto O'Rourke.
Oh, of course.
What are you doing there? Like, yeah. What is happening? You know, and he's such a wild card. Like every day he changes. Is he a centrist? Oh no, he's a radical who criticizes Israel. Oh no, no, he's not actually. He's backpedaling on that now.
right.
Yeah, I think he's ripe for comedy. I think Andrew Yang, going back to the Yang Gang, the fact that he's somehow become deeply entrenched in the alt-right is pretty hilarious.
I don't know. Yeah. What is the deal with that? And why did they pick up him?
So there. What essentially happened is it was just meme warfare as well as the whole UBI $1,000 stuff. So a lot of the people who inhabit that, I guess, Black Pill 4chan worldview of nihilism, internet nihilism, came to the realization that Donald Trump didn't give them, I guess, their racist whatever they were expecting. And now they're ready to say, well, to hell with politics, but if we get Andrew Yang in, we'll at least get $1,000 and that'll help us, I don't know, play video games till the end of time.
Yeah.
And from there, it just sort of morphed into this vehicle of incredible memeing.
Baked Alaska made a song about it.
It just blew up.
Yeah.
And once again, it's hard to discern how much of it is just for the lulz and how much of it was serious. But it came to the point that, you know, Yang's campaign manager had to try to distance himself. Obviously, like, Andrew Yang as the candidate has never said anything remotely, you know, alt-rightish.
No, or anti-Semitic.
Or, yeah.
You definitely can't label him with that brush.
But he also wants to sort of take advantage of the online clicks and engagement to raise his profile.
Right. I mean, who's going to fight the fact that you've suddenly gotten millions and millions of new, like, followers?
Yeah.
Right. So how is he polling? How's Yang polling right now?
It's very low.
I mean, he's still at 1% or something.
Yeah, yeah, he's trying to get to the debates. And to get to the debates, you have to have an X amount of either polling data or have raised X amount of money.
Yeah.
So that's what he's just – that is his goal and it had been his goal from the outset, just to try to get into the debates.
Yeah,
I don't think he will make that bar.
No,
that's what Gravel is aiming at doing too, is to get into the debates.
Yeah,
and if Yang can't do it, then I don't think Gravel will. But it will be cool to see all of them debate. You know, just every candidate should be on that debate stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially, you know, considering how 2016 went. Was it 2016? Yeah, 2016, where it was just this monolith of Hillary Clinton running and Bernie Sanders. Had to have a whole array of voices, at least on the Democratic side, to voice concerns across the spectrum. Obviously, like, you know, we would ideally like Bernie Sanders to do it to get the gig anyways, but just to have X amount of voices out there helps to raise profile. And a lot of, like, issues that
Gravel, like you said, is going to be pushing everyone from the center to the left.
Yes, yeah,
you
know, see, like, that over the window shift, yeah, a little bit left.
Yeah, the idea, yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's huge.
Right, that's what their whole campaign is about, the Overton window. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
So,
and I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
Shine on, you crazy diamonds.
So, okay, my next question just is this: there's some people who are saying that they're very concerned about a Trump second term. Because there's so many candidates on the Democratic side that nothing's coalescing, that no one's really coming forward.
It's the primaries, though. This is the time to, like, take swings and, like, yeah, you know, and talk dirt and then throw it. Like, that's what the primaries are for. Like, people are already starting to freak out about the fact that no one's unified.
Yeah, yeah. I feel that there's just hysteria amongst at least a lot of the establishment Democrats who don't want the same infighting or fear this leftist rise, this, like, what they, I guess, derisively call the Bernie bros.
Yeah.
And they don't want to give them as much of a voice as they deserve, and they just want their establishment corporate kind of, you know, entity, whether that's, yeah, Mayor Pete or Joe Biden. and so they don't want this dirty infighting that will probably linger or give Trump some ammunition, who knows.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with Lance in that, you know, during the primaries is a time to throw your barbs and to find which candidate speaks for the
people.
For the people.
Ideally.
Yeah.
Well, in theory.
And a lot of times people will talk about Bernie bros you know, the socialist wing of the Democratic Party as being maybe, I don't know, white or not woke enough. But the fact that the kind of the guy for the center, you know, for the more supposedly woke side of the Democratic Party might very well end up being Joe Biden sort of puts that all to bed.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
good old smelly, touchy Joe.
Joe's got like a history of like almost 40 years in politics or 50 years in politics.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take much.
A cursory Google search.
Just saying like, hey, this guy isn't woke whatsoever. I mean, I feel his entire woke stature is entirely due to being Obama's vice president.
That's 8 years of your basically entire political career.
Yeah. And how woke was Obama?
Yeah,
it's an interesting moment. I mean, I'm not at all a fan of Biden, politically. I don't even particularly care for him as a person. I don't know him, personally. But it is, I do wonder to what extent it will be good for the Bernie bros if Biden gets to be, like he does run and starts to be the guy for the other side.
Do you mean in terms of them being able to differentiate themselves from that bro status? Like,
I mean, not having that status hang around their neck.
Right, right.
Yeah, but I mean, because so now there's really that whole line of attack will be closed off if the debate, if it comes down to a choice between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's
– and also the age problem will go away.
I you know what? I don't think so. I maybe I'm just pessimistic on this. I think they will somehow continue to make Bernie Sanders' age an issue while at the same time – you know, downplaying Joe Biden's age issue. I know, and there's just, it's just, maybe I'm just really cynical about this, but I just have the way that the framing about this whole specter just seems that they're willing to overlook whatever negatives that they're willing to throw across any candidate in favor of Bernie, Joe Biden.
Yeah, I guess, but I just don't think people aren't idiots. You know, you can say what you like. You can try to use the same tactic over and over again, despite the facts. But it'd be a lot easier with Kamala Harris as the person to try to shut down Bernie Sanders than it will be with Joe Biden.
Right. Yeah, I do agree with you there.
Yeah. And that's the hard-hitting political analysis from two Canadians.
Right, no. Well, I love the horse race. The horse race is so great because, you know, you can just sit back and spout, you know, shit that you just happen to think, and it sounds like you're doing something. So that's what we've been doing here. But here's my concern about the 2020 election, and it's not necessarily a broad concern or particularly well thought out even, but it's just that that I feel as though the election of Donald Trump and the combined with the Bernie Sanders campaign not being given its shot. In a way, not that Sanders lost, okay, but nonetheless, there was so much momentum left over that has created a time where people like you and I, that you guys and myself and others can try to open up the spectrum of what left opinion could be and create channels and conversations that are far outside the mainstream. But as the 2020 election rolls along, no matter what the outcome, there's going to be more and more pressure on all the different types of leftists to basically circle the wagons and get on board with whoever the Democratic candidate is. And that at the end of that, if we win, then there's not going to be a lot of space left over for continued left discussion. And, you know, that gets a lot of attention, but even someone like people like Chapo might find themselves dwindling, and that if Trump wins, then, you know, everyone's just going to be so discouraged that they won't get, out of bed for 4 years. It's just going to be, and it's like, I can't listen to any more left or political content because it makes me drink so much. So I don't know, but what do you think?
In terms of where the election is going to be headed itself? I think you've already seen the pendulum swing a little bit in the positive direction. I mean, I know that Dave just said he's a pessimist, but I think the optimistic side of this is that we never used to hear Americans talking about universal healthcare or single payer healthcare as a right, as like, you know, an inalienable human right, as part of something that every human should have just based on the fact that they're alive, right? That is now a talking point, and that is a talking point that everyone has to address. So that's good. I say keep pushing it further. Education should be free. Everyone should have the right to education. I mean, how far will this go? Maybe, you know, the means of production should be owned by the workers. I don't know. But either way, if someone said that right now, that last one, it would be considered like incredibly radical for any major U.S. politician to say that sentence. If we keep pushing the pendulum to the left, and if, you know, the left Democratic Party can keep defining itself by that, I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of these things are overwhelmingly popular with the younger generations, right? It's the younger generations who are coming out in droves to these Bernie Sanders rallies and are saying that we don't want student debt looming over our heads for the rest of our lives, and why should we?
I think you may be onto something. If the Democratic candidates have to say, oh, no, I'm not like those other guys. I'm not a radical. I don't think that the workers should outright own all the means of production. If that's like that's the dividing line between respectability and being, you know, a fringe candidate, well, that's pretty good. Instead of saying, oh, no, I'm not like those radicals who want universal medical, you know, universal health care. You know, but that's kind of this Overton window approach to politics. And I'm not entirely sure I buy that or not.
Or whether it works in the U.S. system where, you know,
right.
Special interests and money play such a huge part in the political system.
You can change political opinion and the population. I mean, I feel as though, like with universal health care, most people have wanted that for most of my adult life.
Yeah, most people don't like dying. It's pretty easy.
If you ask most people, would you like to have universal health care and free access to medical treatment? You know, almost everyone said yes. I mean, there were some people who said no, but it certainly was the majority who said yes for years and years and years. But there was no movement on it because what mattered was not what the population wanted. But now, because of Sanders and because of the shakeup in the established parties, there's a feeling that they have to do something, and I guess that's what they're going to do. And that would be great if they could get that through.
And we shouldn't discount the role that modern media has to play in it as well, because in the past, you know, the general public was only consuming the media from your traditional television or print newspaper, whereas now that there are a lot of factions such as YouTube or podcasts, you know, and those latter two are incredibly popular with the millennial generation
The majority of younger generations get all their information from YouTube.
Yeah. So, and in those situations, there is no safeguard or I guess, there's no like gatekeeper to determine.
Besides YouTube.
Besides YouTube, Facebook, Twitter.
Who thwarted us once.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I need to talk to you guys about that before I let you go. Here's one other thing before we get to the meat of this, which is I don't know why I didn't ask you this at the start.
Who are these jabronis?
Well, no. Why did you guys – did you ever figure out – I'll just ask this now. Did you ever figure out why you guys got kicked off YouTube?
So this is unheard of. We got an official response publicly from the YouTube Twitter account, the team YouTube support account, that basically just said, we have acknowledged that your account was deleted in error. We are working as quickly as we can to fix it. That a lot of people, especially people who were helping and, you know, protesting on our behalf and everything, they said that was unheard of. Like, so many of them were like, I would have done anything to get an actual statement from YouTube saying that it was an error that we deleted your account, right? That's as far as a revelation as we've had. We had a couple people who volunteered to look it up for us and said they were going to try and track the amount of like hates and flags and pings we got. I haven't heard back from them yet. But yeah, I mean, to answer that question, no, it's we still don't know who may have false flagged our videos. I mean, I have very strong suspects.
You know which videos it was that caused them to cancel you guys?
PewDiePie.
Yeah, it was Joe Rogan and PewDiePie were the two videos that were getting the most views for us and
the most hate.
And the most hate. Yeah. And they both have a legion of fans that are more online and more, let's say, vindictive.
Yeah. You can see some public coordinated attacks in the comment section, for example. Like, there's words that can get your video flagged if the comments alone have, you know, questionable language in them.
Yeah, now more than ever.
Yes, exactly. Right. So, I mean, we put up some
some filters. We try to get rid of people who are talking about anti-Semitic, or we try to put in as many dog whistles to, you know, cancel the alt-right trolls. But there were times when all of a sudden, you know, all those numbers would pop up, you know, the brackets would pop up, which is their way of hiding the quote-unquote Jewish question, things like that. We would try to delete them as we'd find them. But I mean, eventually, if your video goes viral and you know, that video now is at 120,000 views, like, you can't control the comment section anymore outside of having a mod or something like that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's, we our videos get around 200, you know, on average.
Yeah, exactly. Comments. So you guys know even better than we do.
I mean, it's, I try to read them all, but I know I don't. And also, you know, I'm sort of eccentric about what kinds of things I delete and what I don't. I should probably delete the right wingers more than I do, but I feel like when I get attacked by right wingers on my channel, that it does me, it's like, that's cred.
Street cred. Yeah.
Yeah. But when someone comes along and corrects a mistake I might have made about Kant or something, I'm like, shut up, get out of the room. You're done.
Man, rappers used to have to take like bullet wounds, but nowadays.
All you need is a comment from those right wingers. I wanted to ask you guys about memes because something just occurred to me. I'll tell you a story. My wife is in nursing school. And she's just about to graduate. And recently, a Washington senator, I think her name was Marcy. I'm not sure. I should know all their names, right? But there was a bill on the floor to give nurses protection so they wouldn't have to work mandatory overtime, and that their breaks are enforced. That their breaks are protected, so that they have a legal recourse if they're not getting the breaks that they deserve. And the senator was like, you know, this is ridiculous. We need to put patients first. This idea that the nurses' rights as workers outstrip the rights of patients to get good medical care is offensive to me. I'm sure that these nurses get plenty of breaks already. They probably spend a lot of their time just playing cards.
All those fat cat nurses, you know, suckling from the teat.
Right. And so you can imagine, I mean, this went viral amongst nursing students and nurses, right? This little clip of the senator saying this. And there have been hundreds and hundreds so far responses, like, you know, like every friend of my wife, all these nurses have like put them pictures of themselves playing cards on their channel, and like put cards in the background of their profile picture. A store that sells scrubs said, you know, get your scrubs here and also discounts on playing cards.
I love it.
And you know, it's, she is not, my wife said, I just hope that senator never gets sick.
Yeah. She'll wake up with a card in her belly.
there's like a little online movement. And I think that mistake, the way that she approached it, trying to shut down this bill in this asinine way, in this day and age, is just going to completely backfire and build up a lot of political pressure to get these rights protected. And it's because people can share memes and can express so quickly their outrage around this kind of topic, that there will be a response right away. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the nurses might have grumbled and all agree, but they wouldn't have had a way to express that so directly and immediately. So that's the upside of
that's also a great story. It's really similar to Egg Boy, and I don't want to try and, you know, compare anything we do to that hero, because what he did required a lot of bravery and strong jaw muscles. But he, like, that idea of,
tell me Egg Boy, because I think I may have forgotten or never known who Egg Boy is. So tell me about Egg Boy.
Oh, so the Australian politician, the hardcore right wing one, and his name escapes me right now.
I think something Fraser.
Okay. Anyways, after the New Zealand shooting, he was making a lot of, you know, inflammatory comments and saying that it was because you had too much of a Muslim population.
Yeah, the Muslims brought it on themselves for
that attack. Stuff like that. So, Yeah. So at a press conference, this young kid, and I think he was 15 years old, walked up behind him and slammed an egg on his head. And, you know, and the politician turned around and punched him in the face and then got his goons to keep beating on the kid. So the kid took a thorough beating for this. But that alone, that image of him with being egged in the face went viral, went worldwide. And it just it completely dethrones a strongman. Right. When you make them look ridiculous at the end of the day, like these people try to uplift themselves as these heroic, powerful figures, but everybody poops. Like everyone gets egged.
Right, right. Like, that, by the way, is going to be the title of this, The Serfs, Everybody Poops. And I'll put the, I had, by my kids, you know, I have four kids and I had to read them all the little booklet, Everybody Poops. Yeah. So
it's one of the great political literatures of our time, though, because it's egalitarianism at its finest. Everybody is equal poop, at the end of the day, you know?
Kings and king, the kings and queens poop.
Absolutely. The monarchs poop. Like, come on.
Yeah. And if I remember with Egg Boy, that guy turns right around and just goes to town.
Oh, yeah.
And his goons. I mean, he's a far right figure in Australian politics.
Yeah.
So and it was at a rally that he was holding in some auditorium. So obviously the bulk of the crowd and his goons, goons, were all the same ilk, you know.
But it, you know, when it's online, it sparks something in people, because I think no sooner than a week later, there was a woman in Brazil who tried to do it to Bolsonaro. I can't remember if she made contact. I think she did.
Yeah.
So there's an egg woman out there as well, right? And that's fantastic.
Yeah, someone needs to egg Trump.
Yeah, that would explain single there.
Well, sir, is there anything I didn't ask you about that we should have covered?
No, that's everything. I mean, I guess if anyone has time, go to youtube.com/theSerfsTV to check out our little sketch show, whatever you want to call it.
And you're blowing up. You're getting big. You're the hot thing. You're hot right now.
Well, thank you.
For as long as the modern day internet culture
attention span.
Yeah.
Okay. Probably
which is,
in
which
fact
is years, you were hot. I'm told.
Yeah, you were hot 5 days.
Yeah.
But still. All right. Well, great, guys. It was great talking to you. I'm going to stop recording.